You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Elizabeth Keenan and Greg Wands on the show with me today. They write under a combined pseudonym, which is called E.G. Scott, and they have a brand new book out. It's called In Case of Emergency. When we're recording this, it came out yesterday. When you guys are hearing it, it would have been almost a week ago. This book is absolutely amazing, and I know you're going to love it. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth and Greg.
Thank you so much. Our pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Thanks. We appreciate it.
You are so welcome. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller? And I'll kick it over to you first, Elizabeth.
I love this question. Thinking about this, I think it's kind of two things for me that happened around the same time, which would be third grade. The first was my mom came to my third grade class. Where they were doing a unit on oral storytelling. And she told this like fantastic story about how when she was a little girl in Omaha, Nebraska, she and her siblings accidentally let a prized bull out at their friend's house. And the way she told it just had the group absolutely enraptured. And I just had this moment where I thought, you know, there is storytelling in my family. And I really loved just the reactions everyone had. And then almost simultaneous to that, I got my first journal. And I remember doing the kind of Dear Diary thing every day and thinking, this is just really boring, you know, my actual life. So I started to kind of write little mini short stories. And that really kicked off for me this lifetime of journaling and creating stories.
Love it. I love it. How about you, Greg?
So both of my parents read to me as a kid quite a bit. And I started as a reader pretty young. And I have this very, when I think back now, I have this very concrete image in my head of being, I think only it would have been first or second grade, in our gymnasium in our elementary school on Long Island, we used to have an annual book fair. And I remember it, I had saved up, I was so excited for the book fair, I had saved up money that I earned doing chores around the house. And I just have this memory of being, you know, the size you are then. So everything seems so large and tall and kind of grand scale. And I remember standing in there and I had my chore money in my hand and I was looking around at this, what seemed to be this like magical forest of these racks of those rotating racks, the wire racks of books.
Oh yeah.
Going through and just like going ape in this forest of books and grabbing everything and being kind of like transported to this idea of the magic of disappearing into these stories that were these kind of like very like foreign, exciting, exotic stories. And I think that was it. That's my first memory of wanting to be involved in storytelling in that way.
I love it. I saw a video online where the two of you were talking a little bit about the new book, but also talking to librarians and people involved with libraries. And Greg, was your mother a librarian? Did I understand that right?
Yes, and actually is currently a librarian. When I was a kid, she was working as a librarian when I was very young, and then she took some time away and came back to it. And she is currently now at the Hampton Library in Bridgehampton, which is a couple towns over from where I grew up in Sag Harbor, New York. She's actually at the library as we speak. I had a call from her this morning on her way into work. They're doing limited openings now with COVID and everything, but she actually is behind the desk right now. So, yeah.
That is amazing. I hear these great stories from people all the time about this sort of awakening that happens to people when they realize, usually when they're very young, that people are behind books, that books don't just you know, come from the magic ether somewhere, that that people craft these things. You know, growing up with a librarian, what was your feeling around books?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of that in that way. We always, you know, there were always books on the shelves. I had my books, the books that I bought and the books that my parents got for me and read to me. I also have an older sister who's a half sister, so she's a bit older. And she left to go to college when I think I was about 6 years old. So I sort of inherited her room when she left. And along with her room, I inherited all of these books on the shelves that she left behind, which were at that time a little older for me, which was part of the appeal. So I was actually reading books that I really shouldn't have been reading at that age. And I think that also just kind of further got me into the kind of, you know, the madness of being a reader, I guess.
So you guys have been friends for a long time. Elizabeth, how did you meet Greg?
We met our first week, freshman year of college. We both attended Marymount Manhattan College. We were theater undergrads, and we kind of laugh about this. Initially, I kind of saw Greg in the group of people, and I had a weird like reaction to him. I didn't think we would be friends. And of course, 25 years later, we're not only very, very close friends, but of course, writing partners. And it was a really interesting time, I think, for us to become friends, because I think we both went into college with the intention to become actors. And certainly by the end of college, for me, I realized my kind of choice, my preference was really to be behind the camera or backstage, so to speak. Just like I really preferred writing. And I think because of that realization, and you know, I'll let Greg speak to his own realizations, we really bonded over our love for reading and writing. And that kind of began a very long career for us of talking about collaborating.
I think so. I mean, that was the thing. I think we, at a certain point, we sort of, and maybe this happened almost along the same timeline, where we did realize, as you said, that we were kind of more in love with the storytelling aspect and the performative aspect of it. And so what we did is we have, I think, a very similar frame of reference in the stuff that we grew up reading, the stuff that we like to read, a lot of the authors we like, even a lot of the films, you know, and TV that we grew up on. So we definitely have a very similar frame of reference, and we sort of, that gives us a shorthand, which was very helpful when we started actually working together creatively as well. We have this shorthand where we can go back and forth.
So what are some of those early influences? I hear people talk about, you know, reading a particular book or a particular author, or maybe seeing a particular movie or play that just kind of, you know, awakens this thing in them that, you know, storytelling can, you know, literally transport you to another place. Maybe not literally, it was a poor choice of words. But you know what I mean, that you feel like you've actually been somewhere and experienced something. Greg, what was that first experience for you?
Great question. I mean, there were one of the big ones definitely was The Princess Bride, which is it's a very meta thing, because it's like the book about the story, but there's something so magic about the way they did that film. And then I read the book actually after I had seen the film as a kid. That was a big one. Stand By Me was a big one, which is, of course, you know, based on the Stephen King. Never Ending Story was a big one. I mean, those three probably are the big ones that I remember as signposts along the way of just kind of, yeah, falling in love with this idea of being transported by a story.
Elizabeth, what about you?
Well, I think like what Greg was saying about being kind of introduced to works of fiction that were like probably older than he should have been reading.
Right.
I was absolutely raiding my parents' bookshelves, and my mom, I remember distinctly, had like three shelves of Stephen King first edition hardcovers. So I was, you know, just reading Cujo and all of the early ones, Firestarter, Carrie, when I was not supposed to be. So those certainly, I think, they inspired me to write about scary things, about the macabre, about paranormal. These were things that I felt drawn to very early. And right. then I also remember being in our town, the Thornton Wilder play, and just remembering the style of how that was written, the kind of the omniscient narrator, and showing all of the different points of view of the small town. And that last monologue that the main protagonist gives was just so moving to me. And I just remember that being a really big inspiration for just writing overall and kind of a style that I wanted to mimic, for sure.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor. Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. Pro Writing Aid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. Writing can be grammatically perfect, but still feel awkward and clumsy. Pro Writing Aid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, overcomplicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of Pro Writing Aid Premium. Pro Writing Aid. Check it out today.
I find it very interesting that Thornton Wilder was an early influence for you. Do you feel like that influence or his style of writing, do you feel like that still hangs with you? Do you ever find yourself kind of pulling back to those influences?
I do, absolutely. And I think very much in our first book as well as our second book, because I think the kind of thread of Thornton Wilder that I've always really loved is this kind of reflective nature of these characters, certainly in our town, where you have the protagonist is looking back on her life and reflecting on the things that she maybe took for granted, the losses she's had. And that's certainly a common theme in, you know, my writing individually, and certainly a common theme in the writing that Greg and I have done together. So again, it's something that I hadn't really thought about in that context, but absolutely. I think those early influences for writers especially are always kind of with us, whether we know it consciously or not.
So after college, Greg, you have gone on to be a screenwriter, amongst other things. And Elizabeth, you worked in publishing. Greg, can you talk a little bit about how that career took off for you?
Well, I was working. We had gone out of school. We graduated in 2000. And I was working a couple of jobs that were kind of, you know, just hustling to be able to then work on creative stuff on the side. I was bartending for a long time. I DJed for a number of years. And then I was, you know, the time that I could kind of get when I wasn't working to pay my rent, I was writing. So I was working on short story stuff. I ended up getting an opportunity to work on screenwriting through a friend of mine who was a producer for TV at the time. And I very fortunately sort of fell into that and then really got passionate about that. I had always loved watching film and TV, and it was, you know, it's a whole different kind of skill set to write. And I was very thankful that I had that opportunity. And as that was going on, Liz and I both were always working on short fiction. We're submitting things to lit journals. We were early readers for each other on stuff and editors. And there's always been some form of creative, outlet along over the years.
I want to come back to this idea of short fiction in just a minute, but Elizabeth, you have worked in publishing for quite a while. As someone who worked in publishing and now is an author, writing your own material, Do you ever look back on advice or critiques that you gave authors and now cringe at that?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, I feel like there's some penance happening. I mean, I was really, really fortunate to get a job in publishing right after school, because I would have gone the bartender route as well, and that probably would not have ended well for me. So I was really fortunate to get a job at Simon & Schuster in a publicity department, which one of the early pieces of advice that was given to me by a longtime family friend who was a very established editor. He said, you know, if you want to be a writer and work in publishing, don't become an editor. Become, you know, do something in marketing or publicity or sales, because you will become very fatigued with all of the kind of reading that is required of an editor. And so I was a publicist, and I was on that track for the first decade of my career in publishing. And then I went on to be an associate publisher, which was kind of more about the holistic part of publishing. But as a publicist, you know, I used to tell my authors, don't read your press. I would, you know, don't read the good reviews or the bad reviews, especially not the bad reviews. You know, and that is a piece of advice that I have absolutely not taken as a published writer.
Yep.
And, you know, it's a piece of advice that I wish I could take my own advice for a number of reasons. The other piece of advice that, you know, I was giving to authors that I do think I take now is, I think for writers, the best part of the process is writing the book. I think once you get to the publishing process, no matter how wonderful the team of people you work with are, and no matter how dreamlike the publication process is, I think most writers would agree that the real reason we do this is the writing. And I think that sometimes the kind of buildup and the pressure that writers put upon themselves about the publishing process can be anticlimactic or disappointing. And I'm really glad that, you know, I've kind of taken that advice over the years when we've actually been doing the writing. It's the spitballing, it's the developing the story, it's the editing process. That's really what I enjoy. And for me, that, you know, it's a personal preference. I enjoy that more than kind of up front and center talking about the book, but that also has to do with my being an introvert. But I think that there's lots of things over the years in my publishing past that I look back at now and I think, wow, I was really talking a lot about something I didn't really understand from this side. And now I really do.
Greg, have you had any experiences where you just had to tell Elizabeth, you know, you have your editor hat on right now, you need to back off just a moment?
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, it's I'm sort of completely a babe in the woods, because this is my first interaction at all in the publishing industry. So it's been wonderful to have her on a lot of occasions sort of have a little more of a perspective on the overall process of it
and right.
Stage advice and that. And we've been friends for so long that I think we understand each other. I think that goes in both directions. Sort of your question is, we're able to talk one or the other off of the ledge when that's necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think we balance out pretty well with that.
That's amazing. Greg, you mentioned short fiction a few moments ago. I would like for both of you to speak for just a moment about the difference in writing short fiction versus long form prose, which you have now in Case of Emergency and previously The Woman Inside. How do these two forms differ for you? And do you feel like that they are different vehicles that accomplish different things, or kind of how do you view these two forms?
Yeah. Very good question.
You know, I think I actually have a more difficult time having my short fiction complete. I have far more unfinished short fiction than I do on long prose. And I think for me, that is because I think it has to do with, as a writer, I tend to overwrite. Greg is very economical. He writes much kind of more shorter, succinct, you know, pieces, whereas I can go on and on. So, you know, I think my short fiction suffers because of that. and I think that's just from a practical standpoint. But I think what short fiction, when it's done well, it really like encapsulates, you know, a full 3 or 5 act structure in a short amount of words and pages, but gives you the same kind of like emotional escape and transcendence. So I think short fiction is incredibly hard. For me personally, I revere writers who specialize in that. And I think it's just an art that I really find challenging.
I'm going to, I'll sort of piggyback off that answer. I think that's a good point you bring up. What I try and do, having written a few different formats or different disciplines, is I try and take lessons from one to apply to the others. And I think with short fiction, I think it is very much about economy in terms of, you know, just, I mean, word count, but also flow and cadence and being able to really take a sentence and craft a sentence and shape it. And so what I try and do is I try and take that sort of, you know, mind for economy and then also apply that to what we're doing now with longer form stuff. And I feel it's helpful to be able to sort of borrow from different things. And in that case, I think short stories, having written short stories and read short stories and continuing to read short stories a lot does help with sort of economy in writing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you feel like that, Greg, with your propensity for economy and Elizabeth, your want to, I won't say flowery, that's not the right word, but to expand more. Do you feel like that those two things work together ultimately when you're collaborating? Do you guys ever bump heads, or, you know, because you do have two very different styles, it sounds like, do they merge well together?
I think they do. I think it's more of a, in our particular case, I think it's more of a case of complementing rather than contrasting. And I think what's fun, we've been able to find a really nice groove because I think our sort of our temperament and our tone is similar. So what we've been able to do with the books is we've been able to sort of find a tone that we can both lock into. Mm-hmm. And then with the actual sentences, paragraphs, chapters that we write, we have a nice balance. So we each have been able, I think, to lean a little bit into the other style and find a really kind of a happy medium that works.
And I think with these two books, we have two reoccurring characters in both, two detectives that Greg created, Walcott and Silvestri, who are hilarious and so kind of critical for many levels of making books work. And I think that they're more in the present. I mean, they're really in kind of the procedural aspect of the story. They're really kind of immediate. And their chapters also following, I think, a good formula for thriller and mystery writing is, you know, that's really encapsulated. And there's kind of an urgency, whereas I'm kind of focusing more on the protagonists and in some cases the villains, where you have more obscuring of details. You have more backstory and flashbacks. So I think that the characters we kind of decide we're going to write are also complementary to our kind of leanings as writers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking, version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. We integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year. And it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan, you'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code Hank when you sign up. Noveler, N-O-V-L-R. That's Noveler.org. Elizabeth, you mentioned earlier that some of your early influences when it came to reading were, you were drawn to darker sort of stories. We all know that in publishing right now, the mystery thriller, especially psychological suspense, is really enjoying a heyday right now. And some of the most popular books over the last few years have kind of fit into these molds. What do you think it is about us as readers that love these kinds of stories? And when I see a new mystery thriller, something with characters that are going to be a little twisted, and I get this sort of gleeful enjoyment out of other people's misery for some reason. And I promise I'm a nice guy, but I love these kinds of stories. What is it about characters like that and the situations they find themselves in that you think really connects with readers today?
I love that question. And I think we consider ourselves nice people too. And I think
of course you are.
A lot of our readers as well would identify as maybe more optimistic, nice people. And I think that's the common denominator. Yeah. I think it gives psychological thrillers really give readers an opportunity to kind of explore ideas and situations that they would never find themselves in, or hopefully never find themselves in. Right. I think in the same way that people gravitate towards true crime or, books and movies about shark attacks, these things really delve into our deepest human fears, but there's a safety in reading them on the page. And I know for me, I'm quite hypervigilant. The psychology of me is I kind of am always looking for the exits and planning for the worst case scenario. So in some respects, I read psychological thrillers like they're nonfiction. I like to kind of be able to anticipate who are the sociopaths in the mix, who are the psychopaths, and what are the possible escape measures. And that may be extreme for me, but I think that, everyone who loves psychological thrillers and is drawn to them also loves to be able to kind of be two steps in front of the bad guy, and people like to be able to figure out what's going on and feel redeemed when they do. Or some people don't like to figure it out and then they feel really validated, by the book overall. What about you?
Yeah, I think there's something really fascinating about the sort of chasm between the average person, the average writer, reader, whoever we're talking about here, of what they are feel capable of in their everyday life, and then the sort of extremes of what humanity is capable of in the most sort of violent and sort of dark way. I was having a conversation recently, and I was talking to a friend about a friend who has kids. And we were talking about Grimm's fairy tales. And we were talking about as a kid, like when you read Grimm's fairy tales, they were electrifying, right? Mm-hmm. And they were they were just these kind of electrifying kind of, you had this visceral reaction. When you go back and read those as an adult, they're terrifying.
They really are.
They're terrible. They're scarier when you read those as an adult than when you hear them as a kid. And I think that there's something about that that's validating almost. It's there is this, the world is a crazy, scary, potentially dangerous place. And there's something almost cathartic about reading about it or the extremes of it that sort of almost feel like grounding.
You can control
that makes sense.
It.
You can get, yeah, there's a controllable aspect to that when you're reading it or watching it.
I'll tell you what, Greg, when I first had kids, I remember getting some of those fairy tales and reading them to my kids. And thinking to myself, wow, my parents were horrible people. And And it looks like I'm going to be horrible too, because here we go.
Yeah, it's like you start to wonder, how did you ever sleep as a kid when you read those? And yet, you know, they're scarier now. It's wild.
It's kind of funny. It's like a great Pixar movie is really multi-layered. You know, a three-year-old can sit and watch it and just love it. But if you watch it with the parents, they're picking up on entirely different jokes. And, you know, there's something for everybody there. I think those Grimm fairy tales are kind of the same way.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So you guys have had a long relationship and have depended on one another to kind of kick ideas back and forth to or to, you know, kind of that first line critique for different things that you've done. But what was it that caused you to collaborate on the first book, The Woman Inside? Greg, what was it about this project that felt different?
Well, I guess the going into the project were very, very different. We had had sort of part of the impetus for the Woman Inside for our first book. And again, we had known each other for, you know, many, many years. We've been working together and separately in writers groups, and we had been reading each other's stuff. But we both had a very traumatic year leading up to making the decision to write The Woman Inside. My dad had passed away, and Liz had gone through a very traumatic breakup of a long-term relationship. And I think part of the impetus was we sort of, you know, we got together as we regularly do for dinner one night, and we were sitting there and we were both kind of talking about everything that was going on and sort of trying to figure out what to do with a lot of the pain and the trauma that we were going through, and looked at each other and we just said, you know, this seems to be the time to do this. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of it. So part of the actual writing process of the first one, again, was almost catharsis. It was almost like figuring out a way to compartmentalize some of that pain and process that and figure out what to do with all of that kind of trauma that we were going through. And then that sort of, you know, through doing that, we found that we really did have this wonderful sort of mutual process. And then sort of now, so coming into book two, we had that framework in place. We were at this point now published authors, so we're sort of at a different point in our lives. I don't know. I mean, how would you say that second book?
I think the second book came out of, we were fortunate enough when Dutton bought The Woman Inside, they wanted to buy two books, which was just an incredible opportunity.
Yeah.
So when we were kind of talking about different book ideas, I think we always kind of start with an emotional idea. Like with the first book, it was kind of about the breakdown of communication in a marriage and how that could go disastrously and fatally wrong when you have aspects like drugs or alcohol, you know, in secret. With the second book, I think we both wanted to explore, you know, a couple of themes, one of them being, you know, this idea of the impact of technology on our lives. And when you combine things like technology and intimacy, mm-hmm. And we really like delved into that with the character. We also wanted to look at, you know, in a workplace environment, when people co-opt your ideas and your work and get rewarded, you know, women in workplaces was another big theme for us, gender dynamics. So we kind of took these like larger themes that we were really talking about amongst ourselves and weaved them into these characters.
Yeah.
So I think the second book was a little bit more like organic in how the plot was born. Whereas the first book, we kind of went in and we were like, I literally said to Greg, I want to effing kill someone. Let's do it on the page.
We're having a tough few months going into
that. Yeah. So that one was like pure anger. But the second book kind of, I think, became a little more nuanced.
Elizabeth, you mentioned these themes that start emerging as the book is created and starts evolving. Do you begin with those themes, or do you begin with a character? Like, what is that first kernel? I'm kind of fascinated with where stories begin. Like, what is that first thing that then starts growing and growing and then winds up, you know, in case of emergency?
I think with In Case of Emergency, now it's always like chicken or egg. It's hard to remember, but it really was the setup.
Yeah, and you get credit on the setup because you came up with a great setup. We were talking about, we were spitballing ideas for a second book when we realized that we were going to have the two-book deal. And we had probably half a dozen ideas at the time. And the one that stood out for both of us, I think, and our agent as well, who was sort of in that conversation, but the one that really stuck out was a great, very straightforward concept that Liz had, which was, what would happen if you were called in a sort of a tragedy, right? If you're called as the emergency contact for a person that you had never met.
That kind of
set us off on the path of that story.
Right.
It was such an intriguing idea that we were both like, okay, well, we can definitely build something out of that. And then, as it always is with us, it's a lot of spitballing. It's a lot of, okay, what could that possibly be? And then we'll go through, you know, a few different sort of pathways and options for that. And then we will, through usually kind of going back and forth a bit, we'll settle on the most compelling version of what that story might be.
So I think it's set up, then characters, and then the characters start to, we imbue them with the theme.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
Where does setting come into the book, or is it just understood that the book is going to be set in a certain place? What is that part of the process like?
Well, for book one, the books are not sequels, but the books are sort of a series in that they do have the recurring characters of the detectives, and they are set in the same world, which is the area around Stony Brook, Long Island. The reason we set the first one in Stony Brook, I'm from Long Island, a little bit east of there, but I'm familiar enough with Long Island where we figured it would be an appropriate setting for that story. That's the woman inside the first book is largely one of the backdrops and main themes of it. Both is the opioid crisis. We had both at the time we wrote it, they had actually declared it a national emergency. There was like national, you know, news coverage on it. Finally. There was the lawsuit with the Sackler family. There was all this stuff in the news. And we both personally had known people who we grew up with, friends, family, friends, who had actually been lost to opioid addiction. And the specifics of Long Island, the sort of the socioeconomic spread of that and what was going on, there are some towns around there that actually were big hubs of addiction and opioid trafficking. And so it seemed like it was a place that made sense for that story. And then so sort of by virtue of that, because we've kept the story sort of a series and had it in the sort of in the same world with the same detectives, we figured out stories that also fit in that kind of geography.
So let's talk about Charlotte for just a moment. In this book, we meet Charlotte, and she has kind of had some personal tragedy that she's still reeling from and dealing with the fallout from. And then she meets a man and kind of chaos ensues. Tell me a little bit where Charlotte comes from and how did you decide to do the horrible things that you do to Charlotte?
I love your question.
Yes. Well, when we meet Charlotte, it's at a really kind of critical moment in her life. You know, she has, you know, recently relocated to her childhood home after having had a very promising career in neurology. She was a neurosurgeon up and coming and kind of had been at the forefront of this really interesting study about how to use brain science and trauma therapy. And had a terrible tragedy happen on the job, which had sent her kind of reeling through a series of bad events and ending up back where she had grown up. And, you know, we're kind of seeing her on the other side of this. She's kind of started to recover from a lot of that difficulty. She's rebuilt her life. And she has started this very intense relationship with a man named Peter, who has before the open of the book, kind of dropped out. She's not sure of where he is, and he's got a very mysterious backstory and job that, you know, kind of keeps him falling in and out of her life. And when we meet her, she is waiting for him, basically telling herself, like, this is the day he's got to show up. You know, there's a deadline on when he's supposed to reemerge in her life. So, this is all you know, the tension that's kind of ratcheted up around Charlotte happens very quickly. And then, of course, she gets a phone call saying, there's a body, you're the emergency contact, we need you to come identify this body. And she, of course, assumes that it's Peter. So we learn about, you know, her backstory, the things she's done, why she's ended up where she has, kind of through the lens of her figuring out who this body is, who is not Peter, and then, of course, who Peter is and what he means in her life.
And I'm assuming that that her choice of career and her former career path are not coincidences.
Right, right. Yeah. So she is currently an acupuncturist, and it's obviously a very big change from the Western medicine orientation and brain surgery to acupuncture. And that actually was inspired by an acupuncturist that I went to for many years, a very brilliant woman who had come from Western medicine, had a medical crisis in her own life and had found relief from acupuncture. So she had switched. And we had had a couple of conversations about the kind of contrast and conflict between East and West medicine. And I loved that, you know, kind of dynamic in one character. So that's why we had Charlotte do that, because of course it contributes to a lot of the twists and turns in the plot later on.
Greg, with us living in 2020 and the internet being such an integral part of our lives, do you ever find that there are certain aspects of research that you need to do that the internet just can't suffice for, that maybe you need to meet people, you need to have conversations, you need to do a little deeper digging?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think there are sort of the minutiae of, let's say if you're researching, I for instance, when I was researching sort of the character development around the two detectives, I have a friend who I grew up with, who's a very close friend of mine, who had worked for a number of years with the NYPD, was a vice squad detective. And a lot of the stuff I would pick up, I was even, this is before I was consciously doing research for the book, but I mean, years and years ago, just spending time with him, sort of hearing stories from him, you get minutia, you know, cop slang and different procedural stuff or sort of on the job behavior that you don't necessarily get going on a Google search. Mm-hmm. So it just feels a bit more lived in. One of the funny things, Liz and I joke all the time about our Google search engines, like if we ever come under suspicion from any sort of law enforcement, like our gooses are cooked, because the kind of stuff that we have is like, you know, how to decompose a body in a certain amount of time, right, things like that. So we're pretty much like, if you don't hear from us again after this recording, it's probably, you know, it's probably due to our search engine.
That's when you're confronted with, do I find a secure browser that'll completely hide my trail, or do I just put my trail out front in front of everyone so that there's no suspicion? You know, these are things writers worry about.
Yeah,
I think we definitely leaned more towards the latter. It's like, let's just get out in front, because it'll be a fun interrogation. Trying to explain away how, you know, like all the psychopathic, searches. Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah. That's
murder
the other thing.
Weapons.
Right.
Yeah.
Just on book two, just the amount of research we did around poison that'll lock us up for a good 15 to 25. Right there, right.
That is so funny. Let's talk the mechanics of writing together for just a minute. And first, but before we do that, you know, there's this fun conversation that writers love to have, and it's about the difference in style of writing. Some people consider themselves pantsers, where they write by the seat of their pants. Some other people are plotters, and there's a lot of meticulous pre-writing that goes into the writing of something. Greg and Elizabeth, how do you, we're speaking individually now, before you're collaborating, do you consider yourself in one or the other of those camps?
For sure. I mean, I would say I'm a procrastinator snacker writer and a pacer, where I just kind of am constantly circling the desk until I finally sit down. And then when I am able to sit down, I'm a pantser for sure. I've never heard that, but I love it. I'm writing by the seat of my pants. I keep saying I'm going to be like a fastidious outliner, you know, hit a word count a day. I just admire those kinds of writers, but I am not that writer.
Yeah, that's
funny. What about you, Greg?
I was going to say neither am I. I tend to be more in that camp as well. When I was writing on my own, when I was doing, you know, a lot of short fiction stuff, it would be a lot of times I'd come up with, you know, a concept for something or an idea, and then I just let that kind of marinate my head for, you know, days or weeks sometimes. And then sometimes there'd be something where I'd lock into an idea that was compelling enough to kind of make me sit down at the desk and actually sort of bang it out. I think part of the thing about A, being writing partners is that we are both accountable to one another. So when we're working on something, it's like, okay, well, I know I need to get this chapter done so I can get it turned over to her so she can read it and then figure out where she's going to take the story from there. So the accountability of a writing partner and obviously of, like, you know, having a book contract are both very helpful in terms of, you know, getting, I think, both of us in the seat. Yeah. And going.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you guys collectively have an idea where this story is going ahead of time, or are you trying to one-up each other, you know, with each chapter?
A little bit of both.
A little of both. Although it's funny you use the term specifically one up, because yeah, we use that specific term quite a bit.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's between the two of us. Yeah. A lot of it is, the fun of it is, like, we joke too a lot about, like, our goal is to basically really make the other person dislike us by the time they've read the chapter.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's also, you know, to your question earlier of sort of, you know, the motivation and what gets us there. I think there's a really healthy competition because we both really respect each other as writers. We always sort of want to, like, the idea of sort of one-upping and outdoing each other actually becomes a big motivation for doing the best, you know, chapter we can for one another.
Well, the new book is called In Case of Emergency. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode. I know you guys said that this was originally a two-book contract that you had. The Woman Inside was a phenomenal debut, and then In Case of Emergency is out now. Are there plans for more books, or can you speak to that yet?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we are working on book three right now. We've got a really fun idea. We've got the first third done.
Yeah.
And are looking at parts two and three. So more to come on that. But we really decided when we finished In Case of Emergency, we had such a good momentum going. And then also with COVID and everything happening in the world, we really wanted to be able to focus our energy escaping into a new book.
Yeah.
So we have more details on that coming.
Excellent. Can't wait. Well, speaking of COVID, I've been asking a lot of writers kind of how this time is affecting them. You know, writers tend to spend a lot of time alone, and, you know, telling a writer that you have to quarantine at home and sit in your office and write is not a lot different for some writers and for most writers, and not necessarily a punishment, but there's kind of a mental aspect that's going on. How has this time affected the two of you?
I feel like, I think we've talked about this, and I've talked about this with a lot of other writers and just people in general that I know, friends and things. And it seems that one of the big things that seems to be sort of a common experience is a tough time focusing. I think there's a sort of generalized anxiety where we don't really know the information that we need yet, and we're sort of all figuring it out in real time. And I think that what that does is it has the effect of, you know, your head is kind of all over the place. It's hard to focus on one thing. Even as a, you know, as a reader, we're both big readers. Even reading, I find myself distracted more often than I would be otherwise. So in a way, I think that having a book that we're working on and having to sit down and write is helpful. I think it's a bit of an uphill climb because it is harder necessarily to focus than it might be otherwise, but it's also sort of great to have something where you can focus that energy as much as, you know, is possible.
Mm-hmm.
How do you?
I think I really took for granted, I should say I'm a very much a homebody, I'm introverted, and being a writer is the perfect job. That said, when the, you know, quarantine came down, I realized how much I relied on going other places, interacting with people, having the experiences of the outside world to kind of provide a much needed contrast in human interaction. And I definitely noticed the difference in in my writing, both in focus and also in my creativity and imagination. So being alone and left to my own devices and being in my own mind, coupled with constantly looking at the news, which right. almost feels like an imperative now. It's really hard to have like the rationalization, like I'm going to just shut everything off because you kind of want to know what's happening all the time. I think those two things have really affected the kind of creative flow. So it's been challenging. It's been challenging for everyone, I know. But I think I've talked to a lot of writers as well who were surprised. I think we all thought, oh, this is great.
Right.
You know, we'll just sit down and finish our book.
Right.
Oh, everyone's just going to be able to knock off a book. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
But pan to me on the couch under my, you know, weighted blanket watching 7 hours of Netflix instead of writing.
Right. Exactly.
It's going to be really interesting to see what kind of fiction comes out next year, you know, to kind of get a sense of what everyone's feeling.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that, actually.
Yeah. Well, the new book is out everywhere now. It's called In Case of Emergency by E.G. Scott. Elizabeth, Greg, I've had so much fun talking with you guys. If people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, where can they connect with you online?
EGScott.com is our website, and we are on all of the social platforms, also EG Scott. So yeah, look us up. We love to connect with readers.
Yeah.
And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. This was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Elizabeth, Greg, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll cut it right there. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. You had some amazing questions. Yeah. I mean, you had that was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. And thank you for letting me be part of your book launch. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Do you need
Absolutely. Let's see. I think Dawn has been in contact with your publicist. I think we have everything we need, but if we need headshots or something, we'll follow up with her. And thank you guys so much. And I'll send a link over when we share this episode, and we'll promote it everywhere.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. You too. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community.